He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. However, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. But if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. And he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. He who kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he is found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. And he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Men contend with each other, and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die, but is confined to his bed. If he rises again and walks about outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for the loss of his time, and shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. And if a man beats his male or female servant with a rod so that he dies under his hand, he shall surely be punished. Notwithstanding, if he remains alive a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his property. If men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished accordingly as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. If a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, he shall let him go free for the sake of his eye. And if he knocks out the tooth of his male or female servant, he shall let him go free for the sake of his tooth. Well, in this section from God's Word, you have a number of regulations, a number of case laws that relate to personal injury, to the loss of life or to injury in some other way. So questions of assault and battery are relevant here. And you might have noticed, if you have the outline from your bulletin in front of you, that with each of our points, we're not proceeding sequentially through the passage, but are combining different verses from the overall paragraph that we read. Part of the reason we're doing that is that that is exactly what judges in Israel would have needed to do. When a particular case was brought before them, presented to them, if it didn't exactly match the parameters of any of the case law that was already here, they would have had to triangulate. They would have had to look at the case laws that were similar, and by comparing the various case laws, reach a just conclusion, a legitimate verdict in whatever the specific circumstances were in front of them. And that's one of the things then that we have to do this morning, is to try to bring together what is said so that we get a clearer picture of what, in fact, God's law taught. And so it's broken into three sections this morning. We'll talk about preventing violence, we'll talk about protecting servants, and we'll talk also about preserving life. Now, when the passage opens, it does so with a distinction between murder versus manslaughter, between deliberately killing somebody, knowing that that's what you've set out to do, and accidentally killing someone. In one sense, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference to the other person anyway, because they're still dead. But it does make a lot of difference in terms of your criminal liability, whether this was something you meant to do or whether it was not. As verse 13 says, if he did not lie in wait, in other words, it wasn't a plan to kill this person, but God delivered him into his hand. In other words, it was providential. It was fortuitous, if you want to use that word. Then the level of guilt was diminished. And so provision was made of a refuge. There was a need for sanctuary because the way that justice tended to be administered at that time and in that place throughout the ancient Near East was that the relatives were responsible for avenging the party who had died. So if you killed somebody whether on purpose or not, their relatives came after you. How could you make sure that you wouldn't be put to death for manslaughter as opposed to murder? You would run to the refuge. Now, while Israel is in the desert, they're all living within a fairly short distance of one another. It was enough to have the tabernacle as a central refuge. But when they were settled in the land, then they needed cities of refuge. And you can read about that in Joshua chapter 20, how six cities, Levitical cities, were set aside as a place of refuge. In addition to those Levitical cities, of course, people always had the option of taking refuge in the tabernacle or after it was built in the temple. Now, just a comment here, sort of in passing. It is significant that the place of God's dwelling is a sanctuary, and that when that sanctuary principle was extended, it was extended in Levitical cities, in places where God's particular ministers lived and ran the city. Because God is the refuge for those who are in trouble, even if the trouble is due to something they did, even if they were careless or mistaken and imperiled somebody else. The Lord welcomed them to come and seek refuge. Now, that is not to say that the Lord was the protector of those who had done unjustly, that the temple or the Levitical cities could shelter you if, in fact, you were a murderer. This was not a get-out-of-jail-free card for getting away with murder. After investigation, if it was determined that it was on purpose, they were to be taken even from God's altar, and they were to be put to death. Because God so strongly, so clearly values human life that the one who purposefully destroys it is guilty and is deserving of death himself. There's an instance where that happened. You might remember David's commander Joab, who had murdered at least two people in cold blood and who had conspired in the murder of Uriah. He went and took refuge from the altar, and Solomon gave instructions that if that's where he was going to stay, that's where he should be executed. So this principle was carried out at least once in historical terms. So there is a difference between murder and manslaughter, and determining intent is a big part of that difference. And while God is a refuge for the oppressed, God did not mean to let anybody get away with murder. Then there's also, along these general lines of preventing violence, of not making people think it's okay to kill others, of cutting down on the vengeance system that prevailed at that time, there's also a distinction with regard to assault versus conflict in verses 18 and 19. If men contend with one another, and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die, but is confined to his bed, if he rises again and walks about outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for the loss of his time and shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. Now, what's going on there? Well, I think the situation that's envisioned is two people are in an argument. The argument gets out of hand. It turns into a fist fight or a wrestling match or something along those lines. Not good, but not the same thing as somebody waiting for somebody to come out of their house and sucker punching him or hitting him with a baseball bat or something like that. In the case that an argument got out of hand and turned into a physical conflict, both parties were punished. Both parties suffered inconvenience. The loser suffered the inconvenience of getting beat up. The winner suffered the inconvenience of paying for lost time and for medical treatment for whomever he had beaten up. What's the overall effect of this law? Well, hopefully to cut down on this kind of conflict. Hopefully you don't want to beat somebody up and then be on the hook for who knows how much money. Hopefully you don't want to get beat up. Hopefully together these two principles work to minimize the number of times that a conflict along these lines would take place. So the law is aimed at preventing violence, certainly at avenging it, but even more than avenging it, I think perhaps preventing it with these clear and defined penalties. And that, again, shows you the Lord's kindness in this connection, because he is protecting his people from their own sinful heart. He's trying to make it more difficult for them to just give way to rage, to vengeance, to hatred, to violence. Well, that then brings us to the second theme that is in these verses, and that is the question of protecting servants. And that comes up in verses 20 and 21, and then again in verses 26 through 27. And in these rules, I think what we're getting is the general principle that you have enunciated already in the Ten Commandments, specifically in commandment number 4, and most especially the way that commandment is phrased in the book of Deuteronomy. The principle is this: servants, slaves, were to be regarded as part of the household and were to be treated with respect and dignity as such. You remember the fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. But it goes on to specify more than that. It goes on to specify that you have to allow rest to your servants as well as to yourself. In other words, they're part of the household and they are human beings in need of rest like everybody, but they're to be treated with consideration. And then in Deuteronomy, that's particularly underlined because after the fourth commandment proper, Moses gives this reason: and you will remember that you were bondmen, that you were slaves in the land of Egypt, and therefore you are to keep this. In other words, he's telling those who have newly been set free from slavery, who are looking forward to entering a place of prosperity where they have household servants of their own instead of being the lowest rung on the ladder of society, of being property owners, householders. They're looking forward to that. And the Lord says, remember where you came from. Remember what it was like and treat your servants accordingly. Give them rest. Give them dignity. In other parts of Deuteronomy, it's mentioned that when they rejoice before the Lord, when they have a feast to celebrate the Lord's goodness and kindness to them, that they're also, their servants, male and female, are to rejoice with them. So the general principle is your servants are part of the household and ought to be treated with respect and with consideration. And that principle is carried out then here with regard to the further treatment of the servants. And this is where we really do need to compare the laws in order to get a full picture. Verses 20 and 21 are about a slave owner, who accidentally beats a slave to death. Ouch! That sounds very uncomfortable and very alien from our way of thinking. And this is where it's so helpful to keep reading and come across verses 26 and 27 as well. Now, it's clear from verses 20 and 21 that corporal punishment was permitted. That in itself can be a little bit upsetting to us. We're not used to thinking in that way, but historically, nations have practiced corporal punishment. Indeed, in other parts of the world, corporal punishment is still carried on. I don't know if anybody here would remember, but something like 30 years ago now, there was an American teenager in Singapore who engaged in some mild vandalism and got caned for it. And there was sort of an uproar on the part of the Americans that they would dare to cane him, but that was fairly normal for them. Well, in our own time, we're not big fans of corporal punishment, speaking as a society, but it has been one of the standard instruments of correction for the whole history of the human race. Now, these verses clearly acknowledge that that can get out of hand, that it's liable to abuse. Certainly there's need for great, great, great care and circumspection with regard to corporal punishment, not just in terms of physical damage, but even in terms of emotional damage. You know, in the law, you're restricted from beating anybody with more than 40 stripes. And the really interesting part about that is the reason that's given. Lest you should come to despise your brother, lest he should seem contemptible in your eyes. One of the restrictions placed on corporal punishment is that it has to be handled in a respectful way, which may be a little bit difficult to wrap our minds around, but that was one of the goals for it. Now, corporal punishment was permitted, but it was restricted. From verses 26 and 27, where it talks about if you strike out an eye or a tooth, then the servant is given the freedom, it's clear that any measurable injury would have resulted in that servant who was beaten being set free. So first of all, any physical correction that was given couldn't rise to the level of a measurable injury, or the person would be set free. So what is it talking about then in verses 20 and 21, if the slave dies a day or two later, then there's no punishment imposed? Well, it's talking about genuinely accidental death from really an unpredictable, an unforeseen circumstance. Because any immediate death would be avenged. Our version has punished, but it is the word avenged. So if you beat a servant to death on purpose, you would be killed. If you beat a servant in such a way as to injure them, they would be set free. If you corrected a servant and unfortunately they died, that was not your intention, then the financial loss was your punishment. Now that still seems a little harsh to us. And so let me remind you again of what I said at the beginning of this section. They were to remember what it was like to be slaves. You know, sometimes our degree of discomfort with these laws arises based on our own perspective. You know, if we're thinking, well, yeah, in this scenario, I'm the householder, and I know how kind, how just, how moderate, how restrained I am. I would only use corporal punishment wisely. Well, if that's true of you, then it will also be true of you that your interactions would be governed by the golden rule of doing unto others as you would have them do to you. That's essentially what God calls for when he tells them to remember that they were slaves in connection with how they treated their own slaves. So we might react against this too strongly because we're assuming that we would be the slaves in this scenario. We might not react against it strongly enough, assuming that we would be the bosses, the owners in that scenario. We should, however, in all our dealings with those who are dependent on us particularly, but with everybody, be guided and be governed by that golden rule of Christ. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And certainly with regard to corporal punishment, that doesn't mean it can never be applied, but it does certainly influence how it would be applied. So the Lord has rules protecting servants from mistreatment, and hopefully the financial loss would also motivate restraint, as well as the kindness, the consciousness of having descended from people who shared that condition. Finally, we come to the subject of preserving life, which comes up in verses 15 through 17, and then again in verses 22 through 25. Now, verses 15 through 17 contain three rules, three situations where the death penalty was to be applied, where you wouldn't necessarily have expected it. In those three verses, nobody died, and yet the offending party was to be put to death. Two of those cases have to do with regard to parents. It says, "He who strikes his father or his mother." Now, obviously, this is not referring to when a toddler is flailing and accidentally clocks you in the jaw or something along those lines. The word for strike here is communicating to us the idea of an assault. You beat up your mom or your dad. Now, they're not dead. They haven't been killed. But that is such a serious breach of the fifth commandment that even though life has not been lost, now your life is forfeit. And it's a similar idea in verse 17. He who curses his father or his mother shall be surely put to death. Another way to render that would be he who dishonors his father or his mother. The word there is the opposite of the word for honoring them in the fifth commandment. Honor your father and your mother. This is the opposite of that. So violence, this sort of egregious dishonoring, are both worthy of death. And yet I put this under the category of preserving life. Why? Well, this is respect for life. That's what's informing this. We ought to have a particular tenderness, a particular regard to the life and well-being of our parents because, under God, they are the secondary and earthly sources of our own life. Attacking them, dishonoring them, is, in a sense, an attack on life because they're the ones from whom we received life. Furthermore, respect within the family is essential for preserving society. As you look about the chaos that so many people live in today, so often it can be traced back to broken, shattered, damaged families, to a lack of respect that was just part of the whole environment in which they lived. So that's why, even though no loss of life has happened, beating up parents openly and egregiously dishonoring them are both capital offenses under Israelite law. It was a very damaging thing. You could not just let that go. And then, in between them, there's another case where there's no loss of life, and yet the transgressor forfeited his own life. He who kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he is found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. What is this talking about? Well, certainly it would condemn kidnapping the way we think of it these days, where you snatch somebody, lock them up, and then call their family and demand a ransom. It would also include slave trading, taking people from their homes and selling them to somebody else, or forcing them into bondage. Why was this an offense punishable with death? Well, I think the principle here is that unjustly depriving someone of their freedom is a very real assault on their life. You haven't taken away their ability to breathe, perhaps, but you have taken away their ability to determine their own existence. You've taken away their ability to serve God as their conscience directs them to do. An unjust deprivation of freedom is an assault on life. At least it's put in the same category of serious offense. So God is committed to preserving life. And then that comes out as well in another special case in verses 22 through 25. If men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished according as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judgment determined. Now, this scenario is apparently two men are in conflict, and the wife of one of them is close by. She's expecting, and she gets caught up in the scuffle. Whether because of the stress of that or because of some blow received or whatever, she goes into labor shortly thereafter and brings forth a child. Now, the meaning of the law is this. If that child is perfectly healthy, if no damage was caused other than that it appeared that the fight provoked the going into labor, even there, the offender was going to be fined. The husband could claim a certain amount, and the judges would determine if that was a reasonable amount to claim. But he had to pay up if there were no damage. If there were damage to the mother or to the child, then retribution was to come in a different form. If any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. If any harm followed, to whom? To either the mother or to the child. So the child is born and an arm is out of whack or something is missing or damaged in some way, then the offending party is punished. Why does this law of retribution, as it's called, the lex talionis, why does that come in specifically in reference to this particular situation? It includes things that wouldn't ever seem to happen. I mean, when would a scuffle that leads to premature labor result in a burn, for instance? So it's clear that it's enunciating a wider principle. But why is that wider principle enunciated just here? It's enunciated just here in particular defense of the health and safety of expectant mothers and their unborn children. I hope the conclusion that we need to draw for our own times is very, very clear. God values the preservation of life inside as well as outside of the womb. We cannot give way to the cultural pressure on this point to allow unborn children to be killed. That is not okay. So you see the Lord's concern to preserve life. And you see that even in the law of retaliation, which we've read about eye for eye, tooth for tooth, burn for burn, etc. On the one hand, this is a law that limits vengeance because it teaches that the punishment should not be greater than the crime. You know, it was often that way. And in the ancient Near East, there's actually law codes that codify this. If a person of a higher rank killed somebody of a lower rank, there'd be a minor fine. If a person of a lower rank injured a person of a higher rank, the person of the lower rank would be killed completely. This law, eye for eye, it sounds so harsh to us, but it's actually limiting. It's saying that there must be a proportion between the punishment and the crime. And that proportion is based on the severity of the injury, not on the social status of the person involved. There's another important principle in here. And that is that this law pinches the rich as much as the poor. Imagine that you could beat somebody up and there's only a financial compensation involved in that. You can knock somebody's eye out. You know, pay a $100 fine and go on your way. If you're reasonably well off, maybe that's worth it. Maybe you don't care. Maybe it doesn't really stop you very much. I mean, you read about billionaires who travel with sheets of $2 bills in their car to pay the fines they're constantly getting for not getting a license plate put on the vehicle because it messes up the look. They don't care about the fine. The police can't find them enough to make them care. Well, you could have a similar situation where somebody's like, I'll personally injure you. I don't care. The fine is meaningless to me. Is it meaningless to have your tooth knocked out? Is it meaningless to have their injury replicated on your body? Even if you're rich, that is not meaningless at all. And so this law limited vengeance, but also equaled out the punishments. Now, very often, it would seem to be the case that people would accept financial payment instead of replicating the injury done to the other person. One of the reasons we think that is that God specifically says that in capital cases, in cases where the death penalty is deserved, you are not to accept compensation, which makes it sound like in other cases that was an option. And, you know, if somebody beats me up and breaks my nose, I'd probably rather have the money than break his nose. So there was that flexibility built into it. But the law upholds justice, a sort of a rough justice. The law clearly envisions a bad situation where people are getting into fights and even expectant mothers are getting caught up in the scuffle. And the law's answer to all of this, what does it do? Well, it leaves two people blind where one was blind before. It leaves two people toothless where one was toothless before. The law upholds justice, and we need that. We must have it. But brothers and sisters, this is not enough. Imagine a world where this was all we had. We need something much better. We need the Lord Jesus Christ. Because not in accord with the exact terms of the law, he offered himself. His limbs were exposed to injury, as it says in Isaiah 50, that he gave his back to the smiters, his cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. He was beaten with rods and with whips. He gave his life. He surrendered his life in order to secure mercy for us. Not just for the accidental manslaughterer to be temporarily protected. No, for us who are not just careless, but malicious, for us who have sinned with a high hand, the Lord Jesus exposed himself to personal injury and death. And that is the hope. This justice didn't restore. No hands grew back. No eyes were restored because of the justice. It's the mercy of the gospel that brings restoration, that brings healing, that doesn't just exact a penalty, but that actually makes things better for us and for all who believe.